Welcome to Pod Warp 1999 Season 2 Episode 6. We are the Baja Men of the Celestial Plane, also known as Tom Truskowski, David hello. Davis,
hey,
Ben Patton,
also hello,
and I am Mark Meckes, also hello. Yes. We are here to talk Pod Warpy stuff.
We're here mostly to, I think, to recite the lyrics to the classic dance hit "Who Let the Dogs Out."
Woof, woof, woof.
Yeah. Well, I think the actual lyrics are who, who. Google Play has the lyrics as who, who, who. AZ Lyrics has it as woof, woof, woof. So I think that I err on the side of Google Play because those lyrics are provided by the publisher.
Which is strange because then the song would be about an owl.
Well, I mean, it could be about one of those rare owl-dog crossbreeds.
Something from Dungeons & Dragons, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they do escape. They escape from the laboratories in which they are bred, and then they cross-pollinate with other owls in your community. This is happening where you live, people.
Would you call it a dowel?
One more time?
Would you call it a dowel?
I think you'd call it an og. if only to confuse cavemen who also use that word to describe literally all things.
Ugg.
Good point.
Although they say ugg, so I don't know. Mind you, they have boots called uggs. Which I think is appropriate, because I think you have to be as smart as a caveman to want to wear them. Hello and welcome to Pod Warp 1999. This is what we sound like with our voices.
And we've gone back to the smart as a caveman jokes from the, the 90s, 80s? When was that? I don't know.
So
how's everybody doing? Haven't talked in a while?
I feel like it's been 1,000 weeks because I keep getting busy saying, hey, can we do this next week? Can we do this next week? Can we do this next week? And then we died of old age, obviously. And then we're resurrected during the Time War, where we died and then were revived by time itself, finding new and inventive ways to kill us over and over again. In this instance, it's by recording this episode of the podcast. So I think that's pretty inventive.
Sounds about right.
Sure. Yeah. That was episode 5B.
That was 5B, which I don't think we're releasing. And there's some debate as to whether or not it's canon. But there are a couple of novels set during episode 5B, which one of which was written by the script editor of episode 5, which does lend the theory some credence. But I like to think of Podwarp 1999 as not really having like a firmly established canon. You know, if you like the podcast and you just want to say that the podcast, what you actually hear is canon, that's fine. Some people like the spin-off comics and the novels and the audio plays, which is perfectly acceptable, even though they kind of contradict each other. Your canon is what you make of it.
It is, and I think we can all agree that we're not opposed to the fan films that have been made.
Oh no, those I do oppose. I vehemently oppose the Podwarp 1999 fan film community. I'm actually currently in the process of suing one of the major Podwarp fan film productions out there. I realize that we're coming up on the 9th anniversary of Podwarp 1999, and to celebrate, I've decided to sue a fan film producer into a fine paste.
What gets to me about the fan base is they keep shipping me with Ben.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Yeah, it is kind of strange.
Although it does seem weird that a lot of those tweets instigating the shipping do seem to be coming from your account, David. And don't get me wrong, I ship us too, but I'm not vocal about it. I keep it to myself. It's something that you and I discuss in bed at night, privately, and it's not something that I feel we need to discuss publicly.
Fair enough. I'll see you tonight.
See you tonight. Wear that thing. You know the one.
This will all get retconned in the next episode anyway, so...
Is canon?
It'll be further explained in the graphic.
What is canon? A miserable pile of secrets.
Well, so I have a topic for us.
Sure. Is it canon?
Well, we'll see. We'll when we go back and do the director's edition of this podcast, we'll edit it all out with CG. But
with another 30 minutes of additional footage.
Exactly. Exactly right, yes. So I have a topic that, you know, when we discussed kind of coming back and broadening our topics to beyond just webcomics, I have a topic that I've been kind of putting on my list. And then I was working on a project and I had kind of a crisis when I came to you, my pals, my buddies, and you have leapt, sprung immediately to action to help me resolve this issue. And I thank you for this. So I'm going to start off. I'm going to talk a lot for a little while, then I'm going to shut up and let you guys talk. Let's start with a little autobiography here. My writing training comes from a theatrical background. I trained playwriting, which, as probably some of you know, is very dialogue heavy, and really kind of designed to focus on character development through dialogue, and a lot of the designing is left to the set designers and lighting designers and that sort of stuff. Then I went on, got a art degree, and started applying that playwriting to comic writing, which works surprisingly well. Again, it's very dialogue oriented, and you don't really do much to describe the setting. You design the setting, whether you're working with another artist who's doing it or you're doing it yourself. You're drawing the backgrounds and the settings and that sort of stuff. So I've been kind of working on starting doing some prose, and I've kind of been kind of doodling with like a novel, and I wrote a first draft of a story that I thought was going pretty well. So I sat down, reread it, and it's a first draft. So it's, you know, there's some plot holes, there's some character development that, you know, there's some things to do, and I know how to do those stuff, but I realized my establishing a atmosphere was not there at all. And that was kind of something that I don't know how to do. I know how to adjust some character development. I know how to adjust dialogue, but this is a part of the writing process that I've never been trained in. And it's making me kind of realize that writing for different venues or different, I don't even know the word, different presentation methods, there are drastic changes in the approach. You know, I know I can sit down and just describe some background, but as soon as I do that, you're breaking the pacing of the dialogue that, you know, I'm used to. So, as some of you have started writing for other formats, you know, your radio broadcasts or prose, I just kind of curious how some of you are tackling some of these different aspects. We talked about our writing processes, but how do those writing processes change when you're writing for different formats?
That's a big question.
Yeah,
that's a huge question. I don't want to step on the end of you there, but I did anyway because that is the kind of person I am. I discovered that when it came to writing jump leads for audio, like the biggest hurdle is transitioning from a visual medium into one that is much based entirely around sound, and a lot of that is dialogue. You've either got to have really good sound design or really good effective dialogue or both. And a lot of things where you'd want to show the audience, you'd want the audience to, you know, maybe see a sideward glance, or you'd want to, you know, tilt the camera a little bit so that they can see something that maybe the main characters can't. All of that goes out the window when you're writing for radio.
Yeah.
So you have to think about, you have to think about the sound design. You've got to think about how well the story you're trying to communicate is communicated by the sound effects and by the dialogue. And like one of the hardest lessons I learned, particularly in writing episode 2 and recording episode 2 of Jump Leads, is you can't have too many characters like looking back on the recording of episode 2, and we may go back and re-record it, is you really, like, a scene can really only contain 3, maybe 4 characters before it starts to lose the audience, because there's got to be, you know, most people, especially when it's a podcast, are listening to it through headphones or sometimes a headphone. So you're looking at, you know, at best stereo output, you know, at worst mono. And you need to be able to communicate clarity of narrative without losing your audience. And a quick way to do that is trying to accomplish too much with sound design or having too many characters talking in a scene. And that was a really difficult lesson to learn. It's just, you know, it was a really hard thing to kind of wrap my head around.
Right.
And I'm still learning how to write for audio. Comics made sense to me. Comics make sense. I think there are different things you can do with a comic. People say, oh, you can't build suspense in comics. You absolutely can. You know, there's time between the end of one page and the turn of the page to the next one. You know, that the amount of time in that page turn is almost entirely in the hands of the reader. And I think you can use that to your advantage. I forget where I was going with this.
Well, okay, I got a question. I got a question for you regarding writing for audio.
Sure.
One of the things, obviously, you can't just have a character say, "What's this?"
Yeah.
Without actually describing what it is. You know, in a comic,
yeah,
you could have them holding something in their hand or you know, but you know, in for audio, you have to actually describe it and do that in a natural way.
Challenge. Couldn't you have the other character in the scene say, "Hey, what's that in your hand?" In that case,
but still, you need, at some point you need to describe it. You can't just say,
"Right,
you know, here's a thing," and expect the audience to visualize it.
And that's one of the things. I mean, one of the things that always bothers me when I listen to audio plays is characters saying things that you know a person would not say in that situation, but it's a necessary thing that has to be said in order to communicate that, you know, oh, this device is here, this thing is happening. You need to describe what is happening on the screen so that the audience can follow along with you. And that always bugs me, but it's also, I think, in a lot of cases, unavoidable. You can only accomplish so much with sound design. Sound design allows you to do wonderful things. The sound of the flurry taking off, I think, sounds amazing, and we can communicate that through sound effects, which is a lot better than a character going, "We're engaging the drive and off we go" every time, because I think that's going to get annoying. But it's so much harder. It's such hard work writing purely for sound, and it's my first like crap draft. My vomit draft of a thing, usually I'm writing visually, and then when I go back and rewrite, I tweak and change dialogue. I always try to make it, if I can't make it sound natural, which is, again, very difficult a lot of the time, I at least try to make it comical. I try to turn the limitation of the format into something that allows me to generate humor. Like, there's an incident in an issue where I need to describe the fact that one of the characters, a character in this narrative, has been kidnapped. He's been taken to another location. The people who have taken him to this location think of it as a sacred space. And the character, you know, the character knows this is a cockpit. That's difficult to communicate purely through sound effects. So I have the kidnappers constantly talking about that this is a sacred place, its purpose, its origins are lost to time. And the character's going, "No, it's a cockpit. No, but we don't know what it is. No, but it's a cockpit. It's a cockpit, though. You know, this is a cockpit. Right. We're in a cockpit." Like, and that turning that repetition into the joke made me happy.
Yeah.
And it's nice to kind of stumble upon an interesting way to articulate that kind of thing. And on the other hand of that spectrum, on the other side of that spectrum, in the other spectrum, in a different hand, through another doorway in a parallel universe, you have a situation where you have to say, oh, I'm strapped down to this hospital gurney. Like, you've got to... And it's difficult. Yes. It's so... Well,
that comes with the format, right?
Yeah, you can't... Yeah, every character in an audio play does eventually get strapped to a hospital gurney, or indeed any other kind of table with strap apparatus. Some of the strap apparatus, by the way. Because not everything has something you can just throw straps onto, and not every bed has a headboard, so you do have to buy, right, like, underbed, restrictions and restraints from websites like extremerestraints.com. It's difficult to articulate sometimes what you're trying to get across, and I think that's something I'm still learning even now, where I've been writing this season of the show for what feels like a year. There are still a lot of pitfalls that I fall into that I kind of have to reread and untrap myself from, you know what I mean?
Well, in the format of an audio play, it makes allowances for that sort of expository dialogue. I mean, that's just part of the tradition, so you're going to have that in there. It's just a matter of not overwhelming your production with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, exposition is always a challenge, I think, in any format. I think that's, maybe that's the core of all this, is every format has different forms of exposition. You know, audio is very descriptive in terms of the exposition. Your exposition is not just historical, but
hysterical.
Hysterical, hopefully, yes.
You're always going to have the fill in the blank that you might not have in any other format.
Yeah.
I'm kind of having some of those difficulties because I'm writing a Jump Leads episode for Ben, and
you are.
I felt my...
what?
Yeah, you. Oh, you're messing with me. Okay. and he apparently liked my first draft. I'm going to put him on the spot a little bit, but
sure. Why not?
He was indicating to me that it's still very much kind of written from that idea of that I'm writing a comic. So it's just trying to figure out that. Make that switch over to the audio format. That's what I'm struggling with right now. So this is a pretty helpful conversation.
Yeah.
Great.
I have two guest writers for this first season, one of which is David and the other which is my good friend, what's his name? Joe Heath.
My good friend Anonymous.
My good friend Joseph Heath, who does another sci-fi related podcast. He does the Watchathon of Rassilon, which I've been a guest on a few times. They're going through and watching Doctor Who from the very beginning, going through all the classic serials, and they've just recently hit the second Doctor, and I've been a guest on it a few times. But yeah, he's writing an episode, and we've gone back and forth on a couple of points because he has a really solid science fiction idea, but it's difficult to execute on because it is such a visual idea, and I keep telling him I can't see this communicated through sound. You may need to change it. And he's done a few rewrites, and I'm not entirely sold, but the fact that we're having that back and forth and that discussion is, I think, important, because it's such a solid idea. I want to see if there's a way to do it in audio. It's like with Doctor Who. Like, they are this year releasing a fifth Doctor audio play featuring the Weeping Angels, and anyone who knows about the Weeping Angels, they are an incredibly visual monster in the Doctor Who universe. They are essentially aliens who turn into stone statues when you look at them, and they only move when no one is looking at them. They are quantum locked. And that's going to be, I think, a really difficult concept to get across purely in audio. And I'm very excited and very keen to see how they execute on that.
Now, do you think in a case like that, where you have something that has been established visually, that it's easier to describe in with pure audio?
No, I don't think it is, because firstly, you can't go into an audio production assuming that everyone knows exactly what you're talking about, and secondly, it's, there are still the conventions of how, again, coming back to the Weeping Angels, there are still conventions of how that thing works visually. The TARDIS being bigger on the inside than it is on the outside is something that doesn't work as well in audio. So you constantly have characters remarking on it, but if it's something they hadn't done in the TV show, I can guarantee it's not something that would be present in the audios for a number of reasons.
Couldn't you just have them use an echo when they're inside the TARDIS?
I do, but even then, that doesn't necessarily communicate the scope and the set and the size of it. You know,
it's, depends it's, on the echo.
You know what? You're right. You've sold me on the echo. Good job.
I was just thinking about the Weeping Angels thing. If you wanted to kind of convey that kind of unworldly sort of just, like, shock, what you do is you have an audio background that's kind of like ambient noise, and then when the weeping angel thing happens, it goes silent. Something along the lines of something is uncanny and it's not normal in the scene. Something like that might help.
I mean, that's an option. I don't know. I'm withholding judgment until, as with many things that are happening in the geek world this year, I'm withholding judgment until I see it, or in this case, hear it. I don't know what that could be a veiled comment about, but it's Ghostbusters. It's definitely
Ghostbusters. Yeah.
Can we come back to Ghostbusters later, by the way? Because I have grievances to air about geeks.
Yes, I agree.
I'm afraid no geeks.
Okay. But meanwhile, back at the point. that works well for audio. Has anybody else written prose?
You can't see me raise my hand, but I'm raising my hand.
See, that's audio.
I also have written prose, by the way, but yes.
Okay.
This is the sound of me raising my hand.
Yes.
So how have some of these processes altered that process? Have any of you run into the similar issues that I had?
Well, yeah, I've tried writing a number of things, and I always wind up hating them and stopping a couple thousand words in, and I don't know how many files I've got, where it's kind of like, too much dialogue, not enough description, and that's just kind of where it stalls.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm writing it like the comic. It's like, okay, this chapter is about the equivalent of a four-panel comic. I said, boy, this is a short chapter. and I'm already on to the next one. And if I try to make it longer, then it feels like it's filler and just padded out.
Right.
Yeah, that's something that I run into as well when I'm writing prose, is I write something where I think, this is a really good dialogue exchange. Oh, it's just dialogue. I'm not writing anything around the dialogue. I feel like prose is not something that lends itself well to protracted or extended dialogue scenes in the way that, say, television or film or audio plays or, sometimes comics do.
Right. Well, like, for me doing my Cosmic Dash prose, I'm not necessarily having too tough a time. In fact, I kind of enjoy writing the prose more than doing the comic. And it helps that I have the comic and the established characters, so that way I don't have to do a lot of setup about, like, who these characters are, because if you're reading the stories, you've read the comic.
Yeah, you're probably sort of reading the stories because of your interest in the comic, or even vice versa.
Right. And then I often do visual additions to the stories when I publish them, that way people kind of can get a little frame of reference. You know, kind of like how you have chapter illustrations at the beginning of each chapter in certain books.
Okay.
Little things like that to just kind of, like, I think I do a good job with description, but having that stuff there also, I think, helps in a lot of ways.
But do you find that when you go into the descriptions, that it breaks up your timing?
I do have sometimes in early drafts where I kind of do an info dump, but I'm pretty good at reining that sort of thing in and finding a way to kind of integrate the background stuff and the description into whatever the characters are doing. Which is tricky, but, like, with enough practice, you can kind of figure out how to edit it into there.
Right. Yeah, I get that.
Okay.
Cool. I'm glad we had this talk.
Well, okay, let's... The other question I have is, maybe bring the circle full circle a little bit, how much do images inspire your writing, for those of us that are artists specifically, do you ever sketch out a scene before trying to write it?
Sketching out an entire scene, generally not, unless it's for setting up something in the comic. But as far as my prose goes, I tend to love to collect art references for things that I like that kind of inspire me, and then I have characters who I actually commission artwork of. for projects that I've not actually started, but I'm starting to look into, just so I can kind of have that visual background and think, okay, well, one day people are going to like this character enough that they're going to draw their own versions of it.
Makes sense.
Yes. I don't have anything to add to that. I feel so bad.
I feel so bad because, like, I rattle off something and all of a sudden just, like, dead silence.
Yeah, that's always an indicator that either everyone hates what you've just said or everyone agrees with you, but you don't know until the silence is broken. So it's this wonderful, like, neutral zone of I don't know how people feel about the nonsense that just came out of my mouth hole.
I was trying so hard to keep it silent just there to screw with you, but...
No, I mean, I think that one of the big things with prose is, I think prose is great for, prose is fantastic for world building and for expanding and expounding upon tiny moments. Like, this is something that gets lost in, like, TV and film adaptations, is in a novel, when you're writing prose, you know, a tiny moment of contemplation that might on screen be like a second of a character kind of looking pensive, like they're trying to do long division in their head, and then turning to address the character, that can be pages. That can be,
right.
You know, a character kind of reflecting upon their time living in, you know, living in the fields of, you know, Dorset back in England, the rolling green hills, the wind, the rain, moving on to, you know, moving to Canada with their family and when they were seven, and forgetting what it was like to be growing up in that sleepy village, and then eventually going back and seeing how much of it, how it felt new and familiar at the same, like all of that stuff, like all of that description that I just did, that can be as long laborious, that is probably the wrong word, that conjures up the wrong kind of tone, but you can labor the point in prose, and you can't do that in a visual medium like TV and film. You can kind of do it in comics a little bit. You have a little bit of control over that, but when you have, say, a 25-page issue of X-Men, you can't have 14 of those pages be Professor Xavier looking pensively out the window. But you get it. I would say comics is the closest middle ground between prose and the way that you can bend time with prose, and the screen, where you can't bend time as much.
That's true. Well, yeah, with the prose, you could have the 10 pages of what's going on in the character's head. You know,
yeah.
Their childhood in Canada, and then, you know, a paragraph, and then there was the battle when the ship exploded.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I'm doing with the Cosmic Dash novella right now, because it's, you know, like the comic is the big action-adventure-y set piece sort of thing, but with the novella, it's just 2 days and the characters' lives aboard the ship while they're kind of stuck in a cosmic line to get into a wormhole. So it's kind of just taking that time to kind of explore these characters and their past and have all this dialogue, and I'm not necessarily trying to force any major set pieces into it.
Yeah. One of my favorite examples of time bending, as well as making small moments seem big, you can make a big moment seem small. And no one was better at that, I think, than Sir Terry Pratchett, who, a single line in one of his books was, "In the beginning, there was nothing, which exploded." And that's a description of the creation of our universe. That is forces building and building until the Big Bang, until everything is sent rocketing out in all directions. Stars form, planets are formed. You know, you end up further down the line, you get soda streams and hummus and, you know, a TV guide. But like that one sentence with a comma, like towards the end, "In the beginning, there was nothing, which exploded." That's a huge moment summed up in a fart, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, then the other extreme is, you know, you got Tolkien, who basically wrote an entire book, but basically they walked east.
Yeah.
He did an entire book about walking east, and then he did an appendices that was longer than the book.
Yes.
And as another example, you've got George R. R. Martin, who has written, I think, a full novel just describing a turkey leg. Like, I'm pretty confident that is one of the books in that series, in what is now commonly referred to as the Game of Thrones series. thanks to the TV show, where it's, you know, and there's something kind of delightful about that. You can spend time picking at the small details, or you can obfuscate or breeze past the big ones.
It's a good point.
In a way that is not necessarily, like, as an example, one of the things Stephen Moffat has a wonderful habit of doing that I don't object to in his run on Doctor Who as the showrunner, is he likes to take big things and breeze past them. Like Matt Smith's final story as the Doctor explains who the Silence are and where they came from and why they meddled with the Doctor's timeline. And it's breezed past in like two sentences. And you can get away with that in a book. And I think the reason people didn't like it in a TV show is people like being able to see it. They like living in the moment rather than having it explained as having occurred off screen. Some of those tools are available in visual mediums. It's just we're so unaccustomed to them that people object or react negatively when they're put to use.
Mm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
But I know for me it. I guess me, because I'm so used to the theatrical or comic form of writing, I feel like I'm long-winded if I don't just, you know, I'm brevity seems like such an important part of the writing process.
Well, yeah. Okay, I mean, here's my question for you. How often do you get other people to look at your writing? Because that should tell you everything that you need to know. Because if you get a bunch of people who are telling you that you're taking too long to get to the point, then that might indicate that may actually be the case. Otherwise, it may just be in your head.
No, actually, it is pretty much in my head. If anything, I have the exact opposite. The critiques I get are I'm rushing to the point and not enjoying the journey as much.
Well, and now that you recognize that it's in your head, it's just one of those things of, like, maybe conditioning yourself to maybe move to areas that you're uncomfortable with and maybe saying, well, let me see if I can add more to this part, even True. If I'm not comfortable with it.
Mmm. Mmm.
Yes. Mm.
I think one of the things to remember to expand upon what was mentioned earlier is that brevity really is, you know, it's kind of very much the linchpin, kind of the crux of, you know, of kind of establishing a point in a way that is kind of intellectual. It's kind of the nub, if you will, the core facet of an intellectual observation that it kind of something that is witty in it's kind of, so brevity is just to wrap this up in kind of a bow. Brevity is kind of the spirit or soul, if you will. Brevity being the spirit or soul of the intellectual.
The brevity.
Let me finish my thought. It's very much kind of, you know, if you were to wrap a bow around it, and if you were just kind of sum it up in a kind of concise, is that brevity is the crux of not the horcrux, that's a whole different thing, but it's very much the hinge upon which witticism and intellectual honesty pivots around, if you will, that the soul of wit could in fact be said in many ways to be, in fact, brevity.
Well said.
Thank very you. Well said. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Don't do that again.
I'm so happy.
That was impressive.
Yes.
Well, we've talked about prose and we've talked about audio. Has anyone worked on any short films or things of that nature, and like, what is the writing experience for that like?
Yeah, I've done a few I don't know about everyone else, and I don't want to cut anyone else if you have something interesting to say, like my little diatribe on brevity and its interaction with wit, and how the two may engage on kind of a spiritual level. But
is this the sequel now?
No, I'm done. It's the tacky tie-in. It's the Jurassic Park coloring book of my previous joke. I've written a number of web series. Obviously I did Boomer's Day Off a few years ago. I did Dalek Gary, which was finally released last year. I'm currently in pre-production and getting a Kickstarter ready for another web series. And then there's also Port Center, which is obviously an entirely different writing concern, but
oh yeah.
the trick with... I mean, it really depends on what kind of style you're going for. Like, historically, my fictional web series projects have kind of been faux documentary in nature, kind of like The Office or Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously very particular ways that people talk in reality that we try to convey, even though the characters in question were a Dalek or a zombie. You know, we try to keep that as organic and natural as possible. But writing for web series where you're writing, you know, episodes that are really going to be about, you know, 3 to 6 minutes long a piece, is tricky. Because you need to kind of get... It's, in many ways, it's kind of like doing a webcomic, where you've got to kind of set up your premise, establish your characters, and then build towards... with a web series, at least, build towards a cliffhanger of sorts, which will then get resolved at the start of the next episode. There's some hee-haws, character, chuckle-chuckle, guffaw, the narrative, and then another cliffhanger. It's kind of like... I kind of liken writing for web series as being like writing those old Spider-Man 3-panel comics that used to be in the... I don't know if they still are in the newspaper, where panel 1 is kind of a recap of the cliffhanger from the previous strip. Panel 2... is narrative exposition, and then panel 3 is the cliffhanger, and you kind of repeat that rotation, and it's kind of like that, only you obviously have much, much more room to write in. But when you're writing for, when you're conscious of the fact that the episodes you're going to be writing are going to be between 3 to 6 minutes apiece, you're thinking, okay, how can we simplify, how can we, you know, does this character need to go on this this tirade about corn syrup? Does this character need to expound upon their... do we need a flashback here, you know? Does this joke about, you know, taking the sentence, brevity is the soul of wit, and then expanding it out into 3.5 minutes of rambling nonsense, does that need to be in there? Or can we cut it? And, you know, so that's kind of something that you do think about when you're writing, and then you think about it again when you're editing, because editing is a hugely... And this is obviously something that affects everyone when you're producing content. You're still writing it, in a sense, right up until you actually publish it, because you're going to be editing, you're going to be tweaking, you're going to be working on things. And it was kind of like that with Boomer's Day Off and Dalek Gary, where we would, you know, trim sentences or neaten up edits and stuff like that. But yeah. I don't know if anything I said was useful.
I think somewhere in there we'll have to edit it. But,
yeah. Yeah, you're going to edit it down to... Yes.
Question for those of us who are still doing comics. Ben. for those of us who are still doing comics, how much editing do you do right up to the point where you actually work on the page? Are you guys... because in my experience, I always end up changing dialogue every time I wrap up a page. It's just one of those things where, like, my page is never done until I've actually exported the JPEG out. So I'm just curious about you guys, what that experience is for you.
Yeah, a lot of writing and rewriting and more rewriting. Then once I start drawing it, I try to leave it at that. But there have been times when after I've scanned it and I'm working on it, that I wound up rewriting again. Mm-hmm. I try to avoid that because sometimes it interferes with what's already been drawn. The way I draw it, it's a little awkward sometimes if I need to say more or less, because then, you know, I've got a big hole or not enough room for what I want to say.
Mm. I'm pretty similar. I try and do a lot of, I try and write way ahead of going into production. That way, I can do rewrites and, you know, rewrite it several times. Before I get to the actual sitting down and drawing it phase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that doesn't stop me from making changes at the end on occasion as well.
Right, because whenever I'm working on a page or something, I'll start typing in the dialogue for the dialogue balloons, and I'll always end up changing a couple lines here and there just to, you know, make them a little more brief, or maybe to add in a little extra, and I'm just curious if that's a common thing.
Oh, sure.
I think so. Okay.
I have a question for those of you who do the comicking, and that is, have you ever written something and then drawn it and then coloured it and then looked at it and thought, this is wrong, and started entirely from scratch? Because I know, as an example, I know David Willis, who does he did Short Pact, he does Dumbing of Age currently. I know that he has in the past, like, drawn 2 or 3 strips and then gone, oh no, this doesn't work, and has scrapped those and then And because his buffer is like 3 or 4 months, he has, you know, he can afford to do this. But he'll rewrite and redraw and kind of take it in the direction the closer to what he's going to. Have you guys ever had to do anything like that?
I had a huge rewrite. I did once. I had kind of started and I kind of realized I have no idea where this story is going. It's rambling. It's garbage. And I probably threw out 7 or 8 completed strips and actually had to go on a hiatus while I, you know, came up with a new story in a new direction.
I mean, I'll occasionally redraw a panel if the panel is not up to snuff for me, but like the closest thing that I've done to that is when I finished the cube, I decided to add 8 more pages into the continuity, so I actually took time to draw 8 new pages and slot them into the comic. That's the closest I've done. I've not gotten rid of anything. I've actually added.
What I've done a couple of times is I've had a completed strip and then thought of like a completely different way to do the joke that I thought worked better. And draw a whole new one with the new replacement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes I've still found some way to use the other previous version, put it up as like a voting incentive on top webcomics or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a few of them on Station V3's got like all the previous bonuses like that, and some of them are alternate versions of strips that just didn't work out.
Well, it's a cool little extra that you can do, though.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah,
as long as I got the time.
Yeah, that's the key thing, is having the time. It's like, if you're up against it and like the strip's going to go up in like 27 minutes, do you have the time then to redraw the whole thing? No. Do you have time to maybe fix dialogue and maybe make some minor adjustments to the art? Yeah, probably.
Right.
And you might even be able to stretch that to an hour, because if the strip is half an hour late, the only people who are going to notice are those the people who are like voracious midnight people, and you get a couple of tweets, and that's it.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of struggling right now because I typically write narrative comics and longer form stuff, and I'm trying to get a bunch of like comic strips going, and I'm struggling and kind of getting in that mindset of okay, I've only got 4 panels to work with. Here's how I get this little story across and punch it up with a gag. And just that's one of those things that just escapes me right now.
That's a whole different format too, really.
Yeah,
that kind of gag, gag a day versus a long strip.
Right. Well, and then it's not even just like a gag a day, like a comic strip, because I'm doing one of the Japanese four comas, the vertical comics and that sort of thing, and that's just like a complete. There's a certain style to them that I can't quite define the way that they do their gags and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things where it's like I'm trying to wrap my head around it, and I struggle.
Yeah, it's tricky.
It is.
So what other formats are there? I mentioned I wrote for the stage in college, mm-hmm. and did some writing there, which not too different. Its biggest limitation is, what you can do live on stage. But what other, there's also writing for games.
Video games, games are hugely interactive. And, at the moment, I'm playing through Tales from the Borderlands on the Xbox. Mm. And I think of like all the different in terms of the narrative, in fact, in a lot of the Telltale games, you've got different character interactions where you can say different things, they can react to those things differently, and that has an effect on the narrative and affects how characters interact with you later in the story. So that's mm-hmm. so much right. Like I remember, I don't know how accurate this is, but I remember the script for Metal Gear Solid 2 on the PlayStation 2 being something along the lines of like 500 or 600 pages for a video game. That's insane.
I can't even imagine. Actually, I take that back. I had a friend who was working in video games, and I started took a shot at writing a video game treatment. And it never went anywhere, and it wasn't a full, the full thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a huge challenge.
Video game adaptation of the full Monty. Cool.
I actually started writing I finished writing. It was a visual novel that my friend Mike and I are working on, a Cosmic Dash theme, everything like that. But it was one of those things where I had like piles of papers that were color coded. That I had to organize based on branches in the story.
Oh, yeah.
And to make sure that, like, you had to train. So I actually, it helped me in that case to actually physically write this stuff down and be able to pick it up, move it underneath one thing or next to another, just so I could keep track of how all these different things moved. So that might be something like, I don't know, you guys do anything unorthodox when it comes to your writing? Like, do you need to be, tactile about it? Do you...
The only time I had to do that was when I was working with Steve Troop on a time travel, integrating a time travel story into one of his time travel stories.
Oh.
We had to, that took a bit of, that took several flowcharts.
Yeah, I had that with a very similar thing. My friend Ray Friesen, and I were working on doing, just for fun, we were going to do a webcomic project called Chronological, which we didn't do, and I think the name has since been used by something else. But the idea was that Q from Star Trek The Next Generation was going to pull a bunch of fictional time-traveling characters to the restaurant at the end of the universe to send them on a time-travel amazing race through the cosmos to solve a puzzle. So there would have been like the Terminator, Bill and Ted, the Doctor from Doctor Who, maybe a couple of people from Star Trek, but mostly, Doc Brown and Marty McFly. And we were sitting there like flowcharting, like, okay, well, where are these characters going? How do they meet? Do they meet? Do they, what interactions? And we ended up abandoning it because it was such a convoluted... I still think it's a great idea, but we had such a hard time wrapping ourselves around the narrative that we had to abandon it. And this was 5 years ago. I think we'd be much better at doing it now, but... that's really the only time where I've like sat down and like flowcharted out a narrative. Usually, when I'm writing a story, I already have a firm idea in my head of where I want it to end, and soft beats, by which I mean like narrative points in the story, not the vegetable that I want to hit. I very rarely write out of order. I can't write a scene that hasn't happened yet because I need to know how I got there in order to write it. And the only exception to that is I wrote the cliffhanger for Jump Lee's episode 9 and the resolution to that cliffhanger episode 10, which is going to be our season finale, before I'd started writing the beginning of episode 9, because that cliffhanger is so clear in my head that I needed to get it out on the page. And I've since actually rewritten it again, but having it on the page allowed me to say, this is what I'm building towards.
Right. Well, that's one of those projects I've always wanted to do, is a good time travel story. So that's one of those that I'm going to end up doing the flow chart again, just making sure... Because that's one of my things. I love time travel movies, but I get infuriated when they don't handle time travel correctly. And I want to do, like, this is how you do it. This is how it's supposed to be done. That's kind of my goal with my own time travel story.
It's like most of these guys don't even talk to a real time traveler,
Yeah.
Write what you know, and if you don't know time travel, just leave it out. Just don't do it. I do really want to revisit that time traveling amazing race thing.
Now would it be easier to just do that project but with like XBs rather than doing the actual characters? Because then it would be easier to market and sell it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be easier for me to do something that, I mean, to have something that's, my own original characters, and I think that could be great, but I also feel like doing something like that in the fan space is, firstly, it's a lot of fun, provided you're not making money off of it, and I think it's also a good way to kind of draw attention to yourself and what you're doing. Like, I did, in 2010, I want to say, I did a Red Dwarf fan comic called Songs in the Key of Files, which was set during the show's first season, and began with Lister discovering... Rimmer's catch of Babylon 5 fanfiction, and ended with the cat being sent into the garbage disposal to rescue Lister's guitar, and it was a lot of fun to write, and we got noticed by Grant Naylor Productions, who make the show. We got featured on the website, the comic ran in the official Red Dwarf fan club magazine, and we want to do another one. But it's, it's been 6 years. I think stuff like that does get people's attention. Like, Gail Simone, who is one of the most wonderful, talented writers in comics today, started out in fan fiction. Like, that's where she started, Stephanie Meyer got her start writing Harry Potter fan fiction. Whoever wrote 50 Shades of Grey got their start writing Twilight fan fiction. And presumably there's someone out there who's just got a publishing deal off of the back of their 50 Shades of Grey fan fiction. It's a snake eating its own tail as it writes its own You know what I mean?
I guess I have a hard time kind of reconciling, like, doing that fan content, because, like, I struggle enough with just trying to get Cosmic Dash stuff out there that it's like, I wish I could do that and, like, play with other people, play in other people's sandboxes. And well, I can't rationalize that for myself at the moment.
Well, at the moment, I'm writing, for fun, I'm writing a Doctor Who fanfic in which the three different versions of the Ninth Doctor meet. And when I say the Ninth Doctor, I don't mean Eccleston, I mean the War Doctor, I mean the Doctor from Scream of the Shalka, the webcast played by Richard E. Grant, and Rowan Atkinson's Doctor in The Curse of Fatal Death. I'm writing a story where they meet, and I'm doing that mostly as like a writing exercise. I write a little bit here and there as a warm-up before I write scripts, mm-hmm. before I write Port Center, and I'm not planning that out in advance. I'm just trying to see where that's how I can make that story kind of develop organically and where it wants to take me. And not only is that fun, and not only is that going to be nice to kind of put that out there and see what the reaction is, but it's also a nice challenge, and it's a great way to warm up. I think I used to write. There used to be a website called Fickly, which was a spin-off of a website called Ficklets, where you'd write stories with a 1,024 character limit, which included punctuations, line breaks, and spaces. And I used to use that to warm up with. That used to be perfect for warming up, and then they shut down, and I tried to do it elsewhere on my own, but without having that framework in place to limit me, I felt like, oh, I'm not being challenged by this. So writing the fanfic is a great challenge. Even if I decide at the end of the day I'm not going to release it, the challenge of playing with those toys and trying to do it in a way that is cohesive and makes sense, but I'm also not planning ahead, for me, that's a fun challenge. And also writing fanfiction that has weight. Not to say that a lot of fanfiction doesn't have weight, but I do feel like a lot of fanfiction lacks narrative. It's people going, wouldn't it be cool if... And, you know, wouldn't it be cool if this character and this character touched butts? Which is, there's nothing wrong with that. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Butt touching is fantastic.
Yeah, oh yeah, I'm a huge proponent of butt touching in all its majesty. But I favour fan fiction that is trying to tell a story, an interesting story, with those characters. And that's something I don't see as often.
I only ever came close to writing one fan fiction story, and that was a Breaking Bad fan fiction, and that one was just it was going to be, you know, when Dean Norris's character is in the hospital, and it was going to be a conversation between him and Walt about Moby Dick, because I saw a lot of parallels between Hank's arc and Ahab and that sort of thing, but I never actually went through with it, but I kind of planned it out, but I never moved forward with it.
Interesting. Okay, no, I get that. That's cool. And you're also a liar, by the way, because you are currently writing what is technically Jump Leads fanfic.
Well, is it a fanfic if, like, you accept it and make it canon?
I mean, Neil Gaiman considers the two episodes of Doctor Who he's written to have been professional fanfic, so I would use that same descriptor for...
Okay, then I'm a liar. I'm sorry.
I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Okay.
You're not professional.
So speaking of fan fiction, you wanted to come back to Ghostbusters.
Yes, I did. Okay, so this is a big tricky thing. So very recently, James Rolfe, perhaps best known to the internet as the Angry Video Game Nerd, posted a video where he said, I'm not going to review the new Ghostbusters, I'm not even going to see it, and basically went on this extended... temper tantrum. That's basically what it was. It was a very calm, measured, carefully delivered temper tantrum masquerading as a two-camera editorial. where he said the new film, because it's not a sequel, because it's not Ghostbusters 3, because it's not the original cast handing down the mantle to a new cast, it is going to be shit, and therefore I'm not going to see it. Now, I have a huge problem, not just with that attitude, but with the attitude of people on the internet who have decided, oh, the new Ghostbusters film is going to be shit. Why is it going to be shit, people? Oh, well, that first trailer wasn't very good. Okay, well, it's the first trailer. Trailers are difficult enough as it is. A bad trailer can make a good film look bad, and a good trailer can make a bad film look good. That's how trailers work. How many trailers have you loved, but then you've gone to see the film, and you think it's garbage, naming no names Watchmen? You know,
or vice versa.
Yeah. You know, Hamlet 2 is an example of a movie that I love, but the trailer made it look like hot garbage. And it's upsetting to me. I find it offensive that there are people who have said, this is going to be shit. I'm not going to see it because it's shit. How do you know it's shit? Well, it's going to be shit. Yeah. Well, how do you know? Because the trailer. Well, trailers are difficult. Okay, but it's still going to be shit. Okay, expand on that. Well, it's not Ghostbusters 3. No, it's not Ghostbusters 3. The Fly isn't The Fly 2. Or The Fly 3, I think. It's The Fly.
Ghostbusters 2 wasn't Ghostbusters 1. So.
And here's the thing. There are people saying, oh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to Ghostbusters. Well, you're wrong, because A, the Activision video game still exists, and B, they made Ghostbusters 2, and you can't unsee that. That is right now, there are two Ghostbusters.
I like Ghostbusters 2.
Here's the thing. I don't. There are some parts of it that I really enjoy, but it doesn't. It's not as strong a movie as the first one, and there are a lot of people
out there. Well, of course, but, you know, it's rare that a sequel is as strong as the first film.
I would argue that Men in Black 3 is just as good, if not better, than the original, but that's a discussion for another time. Ghostbusters 2 is in the eyes of many, a weak sequel. Some consider it to be a bad movie. It is a flawed movie. As someone pointed out, it's a shame Viggo's plan didn't come to fruition, because he would have been absolutely unstoppable as a one-year-old baby. And that's Ghostbusters. Here's the thing. At worst, the new Ghostbusters movie is going to be as bad as Ghostbusters 2. That is the worst it can possibly be. It doesn't look like it's going to be bad, but people have decided it's going to be bad. And I think this is in part because it's a female cast. I know that a lot of people say, oh no, it's not because of that, it just looks bad. It's not because it's women, it's just because it looks bad. You're spending a lot of time complaining about a movie just because it's bad. There have been bad trailers released, over hundreds and thousands of bad trailers over the years, four remakes, no less, that you haven't cared one tiny iota about, but it's Ghostbusters and it's women. Like, if it had just been a bad trailer, if it had been Paul Rudd, Seth Rogen, and two other people whose names I can't think of right now, you would have gone, oh, that looks disappointing. And you would have left it at that. It's because there are women. And the fact that people are trying to dance around that with, well, maybe it's really just about the trailer and it's... No, it's just acknowledge, be true to yourself and say, you know what? I don't like the fact that this has women in it. And there are people out there who are doing that, and they are shitty people. But they're more honest with themselves than you are for saying, well, it's just because of the trailer. It's not just because of the trailer. It's, you know, the fact that it's women is, I think, a reason people don't like it. The fact that it's a reboot is, I think, one of the reasons that people don't like it, as if reboots are inherently terrible. The number of times I've been at someone's house and they said, oh, reboots are always terrible, and I look over at their DVD shelf and they've got Scarface or Battlestar Galactica or The Fly, you know, as if these things are not reboots. Scarface is a reboot. It's a remake, you know, and a lot of people... It's widely considered to be one of the best gangster movies of all time, and it's a remake, and you have to acknowledge that. Remakes, I think, are as often good as they are bad. Battlestar Galactica, Ron D. Moore's vision for Battlestar Galactica isn't just a brilliant remake, it surpasses the original, and it's one of the best American science fiction shows ever shot in Canada. And I think that to say all remakes are rubbish, you know, undermines the quality remakes and reboots that we have experienced, that you own on your own. I have a huge swathes of Doctor Who, old and new, including the reboot with Grand Moff Tarkin, whose name eludes me right now.
Christopher Lee.
Peter Cushing. Thank you. Although I would watch Doctor Who with Christopher Lee. I would have watched the crap out of a Christopher Lee Doctor Who movie. But yeah, just people have this idea in their head that reboots and remakes are inherently creatively devoid, and that is simply not true. And there are people out there who believe that the Ghostbusters movie is going to be terrible because it has women in it, as if changing the main characters from being male to female means that it's going to be a lower quality movie. And the big problem is that from Hollywood's perspective, so much is riding on this movie. If we want more female-led movies, this movie can't just be very good. It has to be brilliant, because you know that film executives are going to be watching this like hawks, and if it stumbles even slightly, they will go, well, I guess we can't do another female-led comedy or a female-led sci-fi or a female-led action movie. Because
I don't agree with that because the Captain Marvel movie, I think, is going to be bigger. I think it's going to be more important to whether or not
female-led
franchises are going to take
off. I do agree with that, but I think that there are a lot of projects that are on the cusp of being greenlit as a result of the success or failure of Ghostbusters.
That's true.
Yeah, I think the Captain Marvel might be more adventure, hinge on more female-led adventure movies, but Ghostbusters might be more big-scale humor movies.
Yeah. I mean, case in point, the 2 years ago, the idea of a Suicide Squad movie was unthinkable. And then Guardians of the Galaxy came out with a bunch of, third or fourth
a-holes.
Tier Marvel characters a-holes, that, we'd never heard of before, most of whom, the average person who isn't a huge Marvel fan has never heard of, and it ended up being a massive success. And I think that the fact that Suicide Squad was greenlit is Warner Brothers looked at a film with a bunch of second-tier characters who don't have the mainstream mass appeal of someone like Batman or Superman. An ensemble movie like that being greenlit and being a success allowed them to go, okay, well, let's make Suicide Squad. Let's do that. Yeah. And movies are pigeonholed. It's a sad fact of the entertainment industry. It's disappointing and it's annoying, but it is a fact. And
true.
Whether or not we get more movies in the mold of Ghostbusters, where we have female-led action, comedy, adventure stuff, is a lot of that is going to hinge on whether Ghostbusters is a success or not. And people are so much, and executives in particular, scrutinize female-led stuff so much more. So much more, because there's this idea that women don't go and see action movies. Women go to see films like Valentine's Day and Labor Day and Boxing
Hanukkah.
Day, Hanukkah Day. They go to see movies with holidays in the title, starring 27,863 celebrities of varying tier of fame,
and Hugh Grant,
and they don't go and like the idea that women don't go and see action movies is to put it mildly, fucking ridiculous. Because
my girlfriend dragged me to Deadpool.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't interested in seeing it, but she wanted to see it.
I went to see Deadpool 3 times, and 2 of those times were with female friends. You know, it pisses me off that the entertainment industry has this complex about women. Like most of the people I see discussing Civil War and Captain America in general on the internet, women. I'm not seeing a lot of men discuss Captain America.
But how much of that comes from this small but vocal majority that's already lashing out at Ghostbusters?
I don't know. It's hard to call it a vocal minority when the first Ghostbusters trailer was the most disliked YouTube trailer posted to YouTube in history.
True.
And I'm going to be very keen to see what the box office is on the Ghostbusters, because I'm going to go and see it a bunch of times. I grew up with Ghostbusters, the original films, and the animated series, which I own on DVD, take that as you will, is so precious and important to me.
Oh,
but
the animated series is great.
Yeah, the whole thing, the number of Ghostbusters toys, my two obsessions when I was really young were Doctor Who and the real Ghostbusters, and this can be exemplified by the fact that I had the real Ghostbusters fire station playset, and I would take the blue fireman's pole out, stick it in the grill on the roof, and that would be my TARDIS console when I wanted to play Doctor Who.
I pulled out my childhood Proton Pack toy the other day.
Yeah?
Nice.
Because I was going through stuff out of storage unit, and I found my Proton Pack when I was a little kid. So.
That's so cool. But I think it's safe to say that if you're going to dismiss the new Ghostbusters movie, here's the thing. I don't like gatekeepers. I don't like people who say, well, if you don't like this, you're not a true fan. Here's the thing. If you don't think you're going to go and see it, that's entirely up to you. But if you've decided to hate it preemptively, if you've decided to hate it just because it's got an all-female cast, or just because that first trailer wasn't great, I have no bones and no qualms saying, then you're not a Ghostbusters fan. You don't give a shit. I'm okay, I'm comfortable with that. I'm okay with looking into my microphone, looking into my camera, which is not switched on, and saying James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, is a fucking shit. And he's a coward, and he's a bunch of other words that I'm not comfortable saying, because I'm learning about what is and is not acceptable.
Fight.
I genuinely believe if you feel you are a Ghostbusters fan and you are not going to go see this movie because you think it's going to be bad because of that trailer or because it has women in it, you're not a Ghostbusters fan. It's as simple as that. You're not a Ghostbusters fan. You're someone who's stuck living in the past. And the big thing, the two big things about the new Ghostbusters, I know I'm rambling about this. I'm going to wrap this up. But firstly, I think it's important that we produce a Ghostbusters movie for the next generation. Stories, and this is something humanity has been doing since the beginning of time. We've been remaking and repackaging and rebooting and retelling our stories since before that we had a formalized language. The idea of saying, this is Ghostbusters, new generation, we're starting over, here's a version of this story for the kids today. Awesome. I'm on board with that because we've been doing that for millennia. And secondly, a version of Ghostbusters that's all female-led, that's fantastic. Tell young girls that they can grow up to become Ghostbusters. Tell young boys that their mother, their sister, their aunt, their friends at school can be Ghostbusters too. You do not have...
Well, the boys can still be Ghostbusters.
The boys can. The boys have been...
Boys, it's not excluding them.
The boys have been able to be Ghostbusters for over 30 years. The girls, not so much. Happened once in the cartoon. Could happen in Ghostbusters 2, but they gave it to the fucking dork in the glasses instead.
Well, I read the comics, so, they just finished the run on the Ghostbusters, but amazing, and they had a full female team in the comics, and nobody seemed to bitch about that.
Well, I honestly feel like most of the people who are complaining about the movie aren't reading the comics. I genuinely believe that. I think that the audience...
I think their only exposure to Ghostbusters was the first two movies.
I love Ghostbusters. I have not read a single page of the comics, in part, honestly, because it's a money thing. I love Star Trek. I haven't read many of the comics. I love Doctor Who. I've read very few of the comics. I think that in comics you can get away with doing stuff or comic adaptations or licensed comics based on a thing. I think you can get away with doing that stuff more because it's not in the mainstream. I think when you have Ghostbusters, a full female team of Ghostbusters, and they're on the billboards, and they're on the bus stop commercials, and they're going to be on the lunch boxes, and you go into a Target, and it's the toy department, and all of the Ghostbusters in the uniforms are women. I think that is when your dude bro, asshole, nostalgia, entrenched, crusted, trash men, garbage people.
Here's my question, though. I was in Walmart the other day, and I saw Ghostbuster toys, but they were in the boys' aisle. Why don't they have them in the girls' aisle, too?
Well, I mean, the whole concept of there being gender-specific aisles is in and of itself trash. It's a stupid idea. Target is starting to pull away from that. Toys R Us also starting to pull away from that. Walmart will continue to do that because they consider, I think, Middle America and more conservative-leaning parts of the country to be their base.
Right.
But I also feel... I feel like the Ghostbusters toys should be in the toys aisle, not in the boys aisle or the girls aisle.
Fair enough.
I could seriously sit and complain about this subject for 1,000 years.
Maybe we could do a one-off special or something.
I've already taken up, I feel like, 20 minutes talking about Ghostbusters because I want to stress this. Ghostbusters is something that is very precious to me. I've played all the video games. I've seen all the movies. I've watched every episode of the cartoon. I had the toys. I had the proton pack. I had the ghost trap. I had the jumpsuit. Ghostbusters is so precious to me and important to me. And that first movie is always going to be one of my all-time favorite movies. But I am not so narrow-minded and so trapped in my own nostalgia and my own sense of self-importance that I feel that these things should not be reinvented and passed down to the next generation. At a certain point, you have to let it go. It's not like Sony are going to everyone's houses and smashing up your old DVDs, Blu-rays, and VHS cassettes. And we've already experienced the lowest possible state of Ghostbusters. We played the Activision video game. We've seen some really bad episodes of the real Ghostbusters, and we've seen Ghostbusters 2. It has been bad already. This could be really good. Open your eyes, open your minds, and open your hearts. You might surprise yourself. If you pretend to have fun, you might have a little by accident.
Good point.
Yep.
And with that, I'm going to stop talking about Ghostbusters.
And we haven't even gotten into Forrest Tucker, Larry Storch, and the guy in the gorilla suit.
That's true. Very good.
Is the guy in the gorilla suit the guy who got shot at the Cincinnati Zoo this week? Or am I conflating my narrative?
That's the reboot.
Gotcha. That's right. When they do the movie, they'll have Andy Serkis doing the mocap for the gorilla.
There you go.
Who else?
Well, anybody got anything else?
Nope.
And then the ship exploded.
All right. Well, I guess I'm going to sign us out then, because no one else is doing it. So someone's going to step up to the plate, and it may as well be the guy whose throat is hoarse from yelling at Ghostbusters for the last 20 minutes. Thank you very much. We do appreciate when you, if you want to tweet to us or at us, we are PodWarp1999. That's PodWarp1999 on Twitter. Feel free to tweet at us if you are listening to the show, if you like us, if you hate us. Let us know if you want us to talk more about writing. Let us know if you want us to talk about more about stuff that's happening in the realms of comics and sci-fi, because these are obviously topics that we all care about, especially me, because I am a trash person.
Like Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I love Ghostbusters. do feel free to email us. You can email us at podwarp1999@comicostrich.com. Is that right?
Yep.
Awesome. I got it right this time. And you can also use the hashtag podwarp1999. Is that the hashtag we're using?
Just podwarp.
Just podwarp. Hashtag podwarp. We do track that. We follow that. If you have any topics you want us to discuss in future episodes, we will absolutely listen to those and may discuss them in future episodes. We can be found online in various places. Mark, where can we find you?
You can find me at entireprizeenterprises.com.
Fantastic. That's Mark Meckers. Tom Truskowski, where can we find you?
StationV3.com.
Fantastic. David Davis, where can we find you?
You can find me at cosmic-.com, hpcomics.com, or on Twitter at hpcomic.
Ooh,
that's an hpkomic.
David threw in the Twitter in there as well. He wow. knows how to. He knows all about the search engine optimization. And I'm Ben Padden. You can find me online at benpadden.net. I'm on Twitter at Ben Padden. My official Facebook page is facebook.com/benpadden. And I'm also, I will be launching Jump Leads this year, jump-leads.com/audio for updates on that. Or if you want to listen to the pilot episode, which we dropped last September, very, very good stuff, very exciting. Starring the voice of Dino Andrade, who was a guest on the show a few years ago, and who's also just recently been announced to be returning to the voice of the Scarecrow in the upcoming Batman Arkham Underworld, which is going to be a mobile game where you play as a crime lord in Gotham City, and you gain the trust and love and admiration lust of, maybe not lust, of established Gotham criminals. Really cool, great voiceover cast. They haven't paid us to blab about this. I'm just really excited about it and really cool. I'm really excited about hearing Dino as the Scarecrow again, because he was, and I'm not just saying this because he's a friend, legitimately...
Sounds like you want to roll in the hay.
Well, he and I are going to do that on Wednesday, but his performance as the Scarecrow is genuinely harrowing in the first Arkham Asylum, so I'm pretty jazzed about that.
Yeah.
Plus, he was in my thing. He's in Jump Leads, and I feel very privileged to have him on board. That'll do it for us. Don't forget to like this, share it, subscribe. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or on quarkdomics.com or wherever it is you choose to listen to podcasts, or you can Google us. I'm going to leave you with these words of wisdom. There is nothing on earth quite like being hugged from behind, unless you're traveling alone on the subway. Thanks for listening.
Nice. Okay then.
I don't know why I felt the need. I felt like I needed to do some kind of sign off, and that was it.
That's
horrible.
Different
words to live by. Nice, you know. Yeah. Gives it that kind of Saturday morning cartoon message at the end feel. That's good.
Yeah. I wanted to say
some work in progress.
I wanted to say something a little bit nice and fake, uplifting, and then funny to make up for the bile that I spent 20 minutes.
Sounds like a ghost the Ghostbusters would fight.
Yes.
Yes.
I genuinely, I just want to apologize if it feels like I dominated the last 20, 30 minutes of the show. The Ghostbusters thing really grinds my gears.
The intro and outro music is Earth's Assault on the Central AI by Tetix from the album Technology Crisis. A link to Tetix's website is available on the Podwarp 1999 website.